have Champion Jack Dupree on the piano from 1972, a song entitled You're the One, from a sonnet release, part of their collection of Legacy of the Blues series of LPs there from Champion Jack Dupree. We also heard from B.B. King off his 1955 recording King of the Blues. That was Every Day I Have the Blues, his version there from B.B. King. And imagine living in a world where you feel like it's better to hide from the truth than face reality. Well, where it's easier to bite your tongue than speak your mind, where you gladly give up your freedom because acting on your own is too scary, and where avoiding conflict, no matter how unpleasant things may be, is easier than embracing change. It's scary, but it's real, and it affects millions of us every year. That's because what it feels like to live with an alcoholic: anger, fear, embarrassment, hopelessness. But there is a way out. There are Al-Anon family groups, and they know what it's like. To locate an Al-Anon and Alateen group in your community, call 1-888-4-AL-ANON, that's 4-A-L-A-N-O-N, or visit al-anon.alateen.org. To help them, you have to help yourself first. And the Saturday Light Brigade features a blend of acoustic music, puzzles, on-air phone calls, community interviews, and live performances from youth and adults, all in a relaxed format that's easy to listen to. Tune in to the show that gets your weekend off to a good start. That's the Saturday Light Brigade, Saturday mornings from 6 a.m. to noon here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Let's hear next from Mr. Floyd Dixon from a specialty record called Marshall, Texas Is My Home. Here he is with Old Memories. Floyd Dixon here on the Deep Blues Hour.
There's my baby, and I love her till the end of time. Well, she's my baby, and I love her till the end of time. Well, she left me early this morning, leaving old memories on my mind. Well, I hope you write a letter, and I hope it won't be long. Baby, I'm sorry how I acted. I admit that I was wrong. You don't have to fly, just call me. I'm so tired of being all alone. I won't sleep until I find you. Life is nothing with you gone. I've been so sick and worried. I thought at least that you would fall. Please try me once more, baby, and I promise to do no wrong.
The other morning, and I crawled out of my bed. I read enough for my woman. It was all for what she said, if you don't know, it ain't no need in trying. You see me laughing, 'cause I'm laughing to keep them crying. My woman wrote, goodbye, daddy. Get along the best you can. Hope you find another woman, 'cause I've got another man, and you don't know. It ain't no need in trying. Why, Lord, you see me laughing, people? 'Cause I'm laughing to keep them crying. Wonder how she called me sugar every time she called my name. 'Cause the way she cheated on me, it's a low down dead in a shame. You don't know. It ain't no need in you trying. Why, Lord, you see me laughing, people? 'Cause I'm laughing to keep from crying. I would go jump in the ocean, but my cousin held me back. Just a crazy notion. Still my future looks so black. You don't know. And it ain't no use if you try. Why, Lord, you see me laughing, people? I'm laughing to keep from a cry.
Mr. Roy Milton and his Solid Senders there with Hop, Skip, and Jump. Plus, we heard from the Carter Brothers from their disc, Blues on Tour, Jewel Record Recordings made in the late 60s. That was You Don't Know from the Carter Brothers. Well, up next, here's Promised Mississippi Fred McDowell and his friend Johnny Woods from an excellent Fat Possum release called Mama Says I'm Crazy. Here they are, Going Away, Mississippi Fred and Johnny here on the Deep Blues Hour.
Mama train time yesterday. Right, so
play. won't do a doggone thing. Cause after a while, you ain't gonna run around no more. Run around in the country, run around in town. You gonna keep on running, tear your reputation down. Cause after what, you ain't gonna. You can run your farm. You gonna keep. You better let me down. Cause after a while, you ain't gonna run around no more. You was me, and I was you, I would get one, I would let that do, cause after a while, you ain't gonna run around no more.
There was Mr. Sleepy John Estes with a song called Run Around from his release Going to Brownsville from Sleepy John. We also heard from Leroy Carr off a nice Sony collection called Whiskey Is My Habit, Good Women Is All I Crave. This was the Sloppy Drunk Blues. They're from Leroy Carr. Well, up next, we're going to hear from Blind Lemon Jefferson from his Complete Classic Sides from back. Recordings made in Atlanta and Chicago in 1926. Here he is with the Church Bug Blues. Blind Lemon Jefferson here on the Deep Blues Hour.
My wife is with me. everything began in two. As that my wife is with me, everything began in two. All the blind is called better, Lord, and what the change will do.
I say, blue, how do you do? Hollin', good morning. I said, blue, how do you do? Oh, you look mighty well this morning. Can't get along with you. I cannot do right, baby, when you won't do right yourself. I cannot do right, baby, when you won't do right yourself. Lord, if my good gal quits me, I don't want nobody else. Now you can read out your hymn book, beat out your Bible, fall on your knees and pray the Lord will help you. Cause you're gonna need my help someday. Mama, quit your sinning. Please, put your load out and wait. As I woke up this morning, looked out the door, knowed my mammy's milk fire, Lord, by the way she knows. If you see my new cow, buddy, I said, please drive her home. Lord, I ain't had no milk and butter, Lord, since my cow's been gone. Now blues fell this morning, and my love come falling down. My blues fell this morning, ooh, love come falling down. I'll be your Lord, I'm dull, but please don't drive me around. I take the rocking chair to rock mama, rub a ball of roll, take the nice teasing mama just to pacify my soul. Lord, I don't feel welcome. Please, no place I go. Now my good gal done quit me. Don't turn me from her door.
Woman, she don't have to wait. So I turned my ear, your drama needs. But I'm just like a rabbit, ain't got no name. Doggone a woman, ain't need. And I'm sleeping in a darling hole, ain't never been. Good is your fault, so it won't run. What you need with a woman, you call and she won't come. While I'm sitting down thinking in the blues creep down on me. While I'm sitting down thinking blues don't come. While I'm sitting down thinking what I won't do be.
For as long as I see any poor thing kind of around. Any poor thing kind of round. I mean, my baby walking round the road. I seen my baby walking down the road. Says she going through places I ain't never knew. Mother, take me, try me one more time. So I can't change your mind. Sound pretty good. Said my mother told me, and daddy told me too. While my mother told me, daddy told me too. Some of these brown-skinned women gonna be the death of you. I'm a sitting down thinking, I hit my doggy bark. I said, now I'm thinking, hit my doggy bark. Says some low-down joker sitting round in the dark.
Music there from Joe Calicut from North Mississippi. From 1967, that was Come On Home to Me, Baby. Plus, we heard from Josh White, recording back in 1935. There he was with the Milk Cow Blues from Josh White. All right, time for just a couple more tracks for you. We're going to hear from Catfish Keith first and then round it out with some Lonnie Johnson. Thanks for tuning in to the Deep Blues Hour. My name is Steve. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. Here we have Catfish Keith and God Don't Never Change here on the Deep Blues Hour. We'll be right back.
down in the pulpit. Got way down at the door. Got an amen cone.
One more blues? Okay. I play you one old one I made a long time ago. I play you the first record I made for OK Record. Fallen Rain Blues. That was a big hit. Storm is rising. The rain began to fall. Storm is rising, baby. Rain began to fall. I'm all alone by myself. No one to love me at all. Long about midnight, and they don't leave until the break of day. My blues start long about midnight, and they don't leave until the break of day. Cause I've got no one to love me, drive these weary blues. Think some people is happy. Baby, I swear you don't know. You think some people is happy. Baby, but you don't know. You don't know the blues and heartaches is headed after that front door is closed. You see people every day. They wear a smile upon their face. You see people every day. They wear smiles upon their face. What you don't know about them, their poor heart inside has got no resting place. Blues, they fall down like drops of rain. Blues.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, remember January 2004 when Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean yelled in a pep talk to supporters after the Iowa caucus, and elite media declared his growling and defiant emotional outburst patent evidence of unacceptability. Yelling and hollering is not an endearing quality in the leader of the free world, said the Washington Post. Pat Buchanan on the McLaughlin Group scoffed, "Is this the guy who ought to be in control of our nuclear arsenal?" Fast forward to today, when Donald Trump states, quote, "For purposes of national security and freedom throughout the world, the United States of America feels that the ownership and control of Greenland is an absolute necessity," close quote. And today's journalistic response looks like a CBS News explainer headed, "Why would Trump want Greenland and the Panama Canal? Here's what's behind U.S. interest." It's simple, you see, and it's not at all weird. Greenland has oil, natural gas, and mineral resources. And you know what? Quote, "Western powers have already voiced concern about Russia and China using it to boost their presence in the North Atlantic," close quote. CBS tells us Trump is falsely alleging that the Panama Canal is being operated by China, but then adds, in their own awkward words, quote, "China has also denied trying to claim any control over the canal," close quote. Takeaway, who knows, really? Believe what you want. And P.S., you're American, right? The New York Times solemnly reported China's increased ownership of global ports in a story making obvious that the fact that Chinese companies are in charge of shipping ports is inherently scary. What might they do? In a way that the U.S. having 750 military bases around the world never is. The message isn't that no one country should have that much power. It's that no country except the U.S. should have that much power. That assumption suffuses corporate news reporting, and China threatens it. So whatever China does or doesn't do, look for that lens to color any news you get. We'll talk about China trade policy with Dean Baker, co-founder and senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. So how do murder suspects get their media nicknames? Luigi Mangione, the 26-year-old accused of shooting and killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, has been called the CEO killer, or some variation, by some outlets. That makes sense, as the victim's stature and the place of his murder, a hotel where a company-related meeting was to take place, was the aspect of the crime that made it sensational news. It's like how Ted Kaczynski became the Unabomber because his targets were universities and airlines. But as Ari Paul writes for Fair.org, right-wing media are using one feature of Mangione's life, he went to the University of Pennsylvania, to say he should be labeled the Ivy League killer. Well, clearly that's meant to deflate sympathy for Mangione. Coding him as an Ivy Leaguer codes him as a leftist, despite what appear to be his much more politically heterodox views. It paints him as an out-of-touch rich kid rather than an anti-establishment renegade with whom lots of people might relate. Right-wing media are pressed, it seems, by public sympathy for Mangione, if not his actions, a result of widespread, deep-seated anger against health insurance companies who inflate their profits through denial of care, high premiums, and delaying and denying medical services with cumbersome administrative bloat. People, as endless social media accounts will describe, have literally died from insurance companies' decisions. Focusing on Mangione's college rather than the target of his attack, this Ivy League angle seeks to turn any resulting policy discussion from one about the broken healthcare system to one about the education system. It promotes the right-wing narrative that academia is full of Marxist professors who indoctrinate vulnerable young people with revolutionary ideas, and that Mangione is responding not to the objective reality about America's healthcare crisis, but to rhetoric that's been wrongly instilled in him and others. And therefore, the lesson of this shooting is that the U.S. education system must be reformed by the incoming Trump administration. Well, Fair has noted how establishment papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times have all used space to shame those with grievances against health insurance companies. And they've told readers and viewers that, contrary to available evidence and a mountain of lived experience, the situation isn't that bad. We should just accept the system for what it is, and wanting to change it makes you a dangerous weirdo. We can wonder, though, if folks are going to buy this attempt to redirect energy from an insurance, not healthcare, but insurance system that lets people die because money, onto the country's educational structure that might give them information to question that. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman's December 17th piece, headlined "How Elon Musk and Taylor Swift Can Resolve U.S.-China Relations," contained some choice Friedmanisms, like more Americans might get a better feel for what is going on there if they simply went and ordered room service at their hotel. Later followed quaintly by, a lot of Chinese have grown out of touch with how China is perceived in the world. But the big idea is that China has taken a great leap forward in high-tech manufacturing because of Donald Trump, who, a source says, woke them up to the fact that they needed an all-hands-on-deck effort. And if the U.S. doesn't respond to China's Sputnik moment the way we did to the Soviet Union, Friedman says, we will be toast. Now, the response has to do with using tariffs on China to buy time to lift up more Elon Musks, described as a homegrown manufacturer, and for China to let in more Taylor Swifts, i.e. chances for its youth to spend money on entertainment made abroad. Secretary of State Tony Blinken evidently showed China the way forward last April when he bought a Swift record on his way to the airport. Okay, it's very Thomas Friedman, but how different is it from U.S. media coverage of China and trade policy generally? Dean Baker is senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, where Beat the Press, his commentary on economic reporting, appears. He's the author of, among other titles, Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. He joins us now by phone from Utah. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on, Jared.
We will talk about news media, of course, but first, there is Trump himself. It's not our imagination that Trump's trade ideas, his actions, and his stated plans about China, but overall, they just don't make much consistent or coherent sense, do they?
Obviously, consistency isn't a strong point for him, but it does obviously matter to other people. So before he's even in office, he's threatening both Mexico and Canada. It wasn't even that clear, at least to me. Maybe they got the message what he wants them to do. But if they don't stop immigrants coming across the border with fentanyl, then he's going to impose 25% tariffs. I'm going to come back to that word in a second. 25% tariffs on both countries. Now, we have a trade deal with both countries, which, as far as I know, and he certainly didn't indicate otherwise, they're following. And it was his trade deal. So what exactly is he threatening with? He's going to abrogate the trade deal he signed 4 years ago because of what exactly? And again, they actually have cooperated with the U.S. in restricting immigrants from coming across the border. Could they do more? Yeah, well, maybe. Canada tries to police fentanyl. So it's not clear what exactly he thought they would do now. He's just said he wants to annex Canada anyhow, so I guess it's all moot. But the idea of making these threats is kind of incredible. And again, he's threatening, coming back to that word tariff, because a lot of people, and I think including Donald Trump, don't know what a tariff is. Mm-hmm. Tariff's a tax on our imports. And I've been haranguing reporters, why don't you just call tax on imports? I can't believe they can't use the three words. One of them is very short. Instead of tariff, because a lot of people really don't understand what it is.
Right.
And the way Trump talks about it, he makes it sound like we're charging Canada or Mexico or China, whatever he's imposing his tariff on, we're charging them this money, when what we're actually doing is we're charging ourselves the money. And there's an economics debate. If we have a 25% tariff on goods from Canada, how much of that will be borne by consumers in the U.S., how much might be absorbed by intermediaries, and how much might be the exporters in Canada. In all cases, it's not zero, but almost all, and there's a lot of work on it, finds that the vast majority is borne by consumers here. So he's going to punish Canada, going to punish Mexico by imposing a 25% tax on the goods we import from them, which I think to most people probably wouldn't sound very good. But that is what he's doing, and it's kind of a strange policy. Now, getting to China, I'm not sure what his latest grievance is with China. I'm sure he's got a list. But he's talking about 100% taxes on imports from China. And following on the Friedman article, China's at this point, I'm not going to say a rich country in the sense that it's still, if you look at their average income, it is still considerably lower than the U.S. And you have a lot of poor people in rural areas in China. But in terms of its industrial capacities, it's huge, and it actually is considerably larger than the United States. So the idea that somehow he's going to be bringing China to its knees, which seems to be what he thinks, I'm not going to try and get in his head, but just based on what he says, that seems to be what he thinks, that's a pretty crazy thought.
And certainly we have learned that tariffs are a misunderstood concept by many in the public and some in the media, as well as some in political office. But that whole picture of Trump threatening to pull out of a deal in terms of Canada and Mexico that he made himself, all of that sort of stuff gets us to what you call your best bet for 2025, which is improved and increased trade relations between Europe and China. Let's not be surprised if that happens for the very reasons that you're laying out about Trump's inconsistencies.
Basically, Trump is saying he doesn't care about whatever agreements we have, including ones he signed. And this has been kind of the way he's done business throughout his life. He signs a contract and he doesn't make good on it. So he has contractors that do things for him, build a building or put in a heating system, whatever it might be. It just says, no, I'm not going to pay you. Sue me. And maybe pays half, maybe pays nothing. You know, he's prepared to go to court and spend a lot of money on lawyers. It's come to be the pattern that most people, including lawyers, they insist on getting paid in advance because they know if they do their work and then come to collect from Trump, they're not going to get it. And that's his approach to international relations as well. So treaties don't mean anything to him. And we could have lots of grounds for being unhappy with China. They have a bad human rights record. I'm not going to try to defend it. I don't think anyone would try to defend it. There are other things you could point to that are not very pretty about China. But just from the standpoint of doing business, they largely follow through on their commitments. Trump doesn't. So from the standpoint of Europe, if you want to have trading partners that are reasonably reliable and won't pull things out of the air and say, I want you to do this, I want you to do that, China looks a hell of a lot better than the United States.
Right. And so we shouldn't be surprised or immediately begin assigning nefarious intentions to European countries who would rather make a deal with China at this point than with the U.S. under Trump. It doesn't make them sketchy or anti-U.S. necessarily.
That's right. I mean, I don't really think they have an alternative in the sense he takes pride in it. He seems to, at least. He says, I like to be unpredictable. Well, that's fine. But if you're Germany or France, your company in Germany and France, you're trying to plan for the next 5 years, 10 years. Where's your market? Where should you build a factory? Where should you look to expand your business? You don't want to deal with someone who changes everything every day of the week. So China just looks much better from that point. And also, again, we're talking about respect for international law. I mean, we just saw Donald Trump yesterday saying he doesn't care about NATO. He's threatening military force against Greenland and Denmark, implicitly also Canada and Panama. Kind of incredible. So in that sense, this is not a guy who respects commitments. So I think it's just kind of common sense from the standpoint of, if I operate a major business in Europe, I would certainly be looking much more to China than the United States right now.
Well, I did want to say I was hipped to that Friedman piece by Code Pink's Megan Russell, who wrote about it. And she had trouble with the idea, among others, that China's investment in its manufacturing was a recent development that was solely in response to Trump toughness. And that's what led to what he's calling their Sputnik moment. What do you make of that claim?
Well, first off, the investment in manufacturing is longstanding, because I saw the Friedman piece. I assumed he was referring to their move into high tech.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's, again, I don't have access to the inner workings of the Chinese leadership. I think he is almost certainly exaggerating the extent to which its move was a response to Trump. But they did certainly recognize that they were dealing with a different world with Donald Trump in the White House than Obama previously. But the hostilities to China, I mean, Obama, the last couple of years of his administration, at least he was selling the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal that we end up not completing, but he was selling that as a way to isolate China. I don't recall if he used that term, marginalize China. I think that was the term they had used. So the fact that the United States was becoming increasingly anti-China or hostile to China, that began under Obama. Trump clearly accelerated that. I'm quite sure China would have moved in a big way into high tech in any case, but I suspect this was an accelerant there that they could say, here's more reason to do it. But right. they've been increasing their sophistication of their manufacturing and their technical skills for a long time. They have many, many more computer scientists, engineers go down the list than we do. So the idea that it wouldn't have occurred to them, it'd be good to develop high-tech industries. No, that wasn't Trump.
Well, let me ask you to just unpack, to the extent you feel like it, the big idea that we get from the U.S. press, which is that, number one, China is worrisome. Their economy's growth is inherently troubling and dangerous to the U.S. And number two, we should consequently insist on, among other things, trade policy that is tough on China somehow, and that will be good for us. I mean, there can be nuance, of course, but that seems like the frame a lot of outlets place their China trade coverage within. China is inherently frightening and dangerous to the U.S., and so we have to somehow use trade policy to beat them back. How useful is that framing?
Well, I think it's very wrong-headed in just about every possible way. Obviously, the U.S. has been the leading economy in the world for a long time, so we would always say, well, other countries should recognize that we grow together, so that by having access to cheaper products, better technology, they benefit, trade benefits everyone. That's a classic story. I mean, that's economists have been pushing that for centuries. And there's more than a little bit of truth to that. And that continues to hold true when we talk about China. So the idea that somehow China growing wealthier is a threat to us is, to my view, kind of wacky. Now, you could raise military issues, and there can be issues. But as far as the economics of it, we benefit by having China be a wealthier country, and we could. I just was tweeting on this. China is now selling electric cars, which are as good as most of the cars you'd get here, for $15,000, $16,000. I think it'd be fantastic if we can get those. I'm sympathetic to the auto industry, particularly the people in the UAW. I mean, those are still some good-paying jobs. But, damn, you're looking at Elon Musk is charging $40,000 for his cars. You can get one that, I don't drive an electric car, but I've heard people say that the Chinese cars are every bit as good as his cars, and they're less than half the price. We can't buy them, though. We have 100% tariff on them. So this idea that we're going to compete, I keep saying, I want to be the economist here. Usually I'm on the other side of these people. Why don't we talk about cooperating? Why don't we look for areas where we can cooperate? And there are clearly some big ones. The two obvious to my mind are healthcare and climate. If we had more sharing of technology, think of how much more rapidly we could develop our clean technology, clean industries, electric vehicles, batteries, if we had shared technology more freely. And in terms of healthcare, again, the pandemic's not ancient history. If we had shared all of our technology, the first and foremost vaccines, but also the treatments, the tests, we could have been far more effective in containing the pandemic earlier and probably saved millions of lives. And that would apply more generally, obviously, going forward. Hopefully, we won't have another pandemic like that, but we obviously have a lot of diseases we have to deal with, and sharing technology and healthcare would be a fantastic way to do it. But that doesn't seem to be on the agenda right now. Almost no one is talking about that from anywhere in the political spectrum. And I just think that's incredibly unfortunate. I'll also add, obviously, a material interest here, that if you talk about sharing technology, our drug companies might not get patents and might not make as much money, and they're not happy to see that. But if the point is to advance public health and also, for that matter, the economics, we waste a lot of money on drugs with the current structure, sharing technology would really be a great thing to do. And I'll also throw in one more point. This is obviously speculative, but if we want to talk about promoting liberal democracy, seems to me having more contact with people in China, having our technicians or scientists working side by side with them, developing a better technology, better way to deal with disease, better ways to advance clean energy, that's a really good way to try and influence use in China, because the odds are that a lot of scientists, the technicians who are going to be working side by side with people in the United States are going to be brothers and sisters and children and parents of people who are in the Communist Party. People are actually calling the shots there. So when we first opened up to China, allowed them into WTO in 2000, there was a line that was pushed by proponents of that saying, oh, this is the way to promote democracy. And I and others said, I don't quite see that. We're going to promote democracy by having people work in shoe factories for $2 an hour. I don't quite see that. And that doesn't seem to have been the case. But I think it's a very different story if we say, we're going to have your best scientists working side by side with our scientists. And if you believe in liberal democracy, if you really think that's a good thing, I think there's a good chance that will rub off. So that's speculative, but I'd like to see us try.
And I think that's where a lot of people's heads are at. A lot of people have family in other countries. They just see things in a global way. It's weird to be talking in 2025. It lands weird to talk about foreign adversary nations and how we have to have trade wars. And in part because of what you're saying, the positive aspect of working together, in particular by sharing technology. But also it lands weird because Boeing isn't at war with China. There are conflicts, in other words, but as you're explaining, the lines aren't drawn where media suggests they are, at national borders. So that misrepresentation of who the fight is between is part of what obscures these more positive visions.
Yeah, exactly. And Boeing's at war with Airbus, too. You know, no one's suggesting I shouldn't say that Trump might be suggesting, but most people wouldn't say that France and Germany are our enemies because Airbus is competing with Boeing. That's a given. They're going to compete. And again, I'm enough of an economist, I'll say we benefit from that. So if the Airbus produces a better plane, I think that's great that we're going to fly on it. If it's a more fuel-efficient, safer plane than what Boeing has, that's fantastic. Hopefully Boeing will turn around and build a better one next year. But it is what it's supposed to be. We like a market economy. At the end of the day, I do think a market economy is a good thing. So we should think of it the same way with China. And again, there are conflicts. Europe subsidizes Airbus. No one disputes that. China has subsidies for its electric cars. And again, those are things to discuss, to work out in treaties. But it doesn't make them an enemy.
And it doesn't improve our understanding of our own as individuals' interest in what's going on to have there be this kind of us and them when media are not breaking down exactly who the us are. And if we had in this country a policy where we wanted to protect workers or we wanted to ensure wages, well, nothing's stopping us from doing that on its own. Well, I think we can expect all of this to amp up as Trump finds utility in identifying enemies everywhere and anywhere that call for conquering in such ways that enrich his friends. But to the extent that that bellicosity is going to show itself in economic policy, are there things you think we should be looking out for in coverage, being wary of, things to seek out as antidote to maybe the big story that we're going to be hearing about the U.S. and China?
Well, first and foremost, I'm declaring war on the word tariff. Given the confusion that word creates, I don't understand how any reporter could in good faith use the term, or at least without adding in parentheses taxes on imports, because it's not a difficult concept. And again, I'm an economist. I know what a tariff is. You know, obviously, many people do know what a tariff is, but the point is a lot of people don't. So taxes on imports, taxes on imports, taxes on imports. When Donald Trump says he wants to tariff someone, he's saying he wants to put a tax on the goods we import from them. That's what he's doing. And that's not an arguable point. That's simply definitional. So that's one thing front and center. The second thing, I really wish people would understand what's at stake. And again, the reporting, I think, does not do a good job of it. So when we talk about putting taxes on the imports, particularly with China, that were making items that would otherwise be available to us relatively low cost at ridiculously high cost. So again, that cars first and foremost, but we're dealing with the batteries from China, a lot of other things. If we're concerned about global warming, we should want to see this technology spread as quickly as possible. I wrote a piece on this a while back. So let's say that the U.S. had a plan to subsidize the adoption of clean technologies around the world. Well, we all applaud that when we say that was a great thing. Well, China's doing that, and we're treating them like it's an act of war. So, again, I'm sympathetic to auto workers. I have a lot of friends over the years who are auto workers, and I respect enormously the union, United Auto Workers is a union, but it's not an act of war for them to make low-cost cars available to us. And just the third thing, when we talk about protectionism, I've made this point many, many times over the years, the most extreme protectionism we have are patent and copyright protections. Mm-hmm. These are government-granted monopolies. Now, I understand they're policies for a specific purpose. They promote innovation. They promote creative work. Understood. But they're policies. They're protectionism. They're not the market. And that's something we should always be aware of in trade and other areas, because even domestically. But we're raising the price of items that are protected enormously and treating this as just the market. So drugs that cost thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars, almost invariably they cost $10, $20, $30 in the absence of patent protection. And people should understand that this is a really big deal. It's a big intervention in the market and also a huge source of inequality. I like to make the joke Bill Gates would still be working for a living. He probably gained Social Security now. He's an old guy. But he'd probably still be working for a living if the government didn't threaten to arrest anyone who copies Microsoft software without his permission. And it really does make a big difference, and it's literally never discussed. So those are some items. I can give you a longer list, but those would be my starting point.
All right, then. Well, we'll pause at your starting point, but just for now. We've been speaking with Dean Baker, co-founder and senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find their work and Dean's Beat the Press commentary at CPER.net. Dean Baker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, among many other things, 2024 was a series of reminders that corporate news media, tasked primarily with enriching the rich and shoring up entrenched institutions, will not, today or ever, do the liberatory, illuminating work of independent reporting that boldly speaks truth to power, that stands up for the societally voiceless, that provides space for the debates and discussions we need to move society forward, for those of us that believe that U.S. society needs to change. New calendar years are symbolic, sure, but they can also offer a metaphorical fresh start. Why not see 2025 as a much-needed opportunity to acknowledge, support, create, and grow independent journalism? We'll talk about that today with two people who are and have been doing not just critical, dissident, uplifting journalism, but the thinking and advocating around why we need it and the role it can play. Sonali Kolhatkar from Rising Up with Sonali and Laura Flanders from Laura Flanders and Friends. They're coming up this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Since Pete Hegseth was nominated to head the Department of Defense, his nomination has raised concerns from extremism experts, just based on the things that he's said publicly, in podcasts, on his Fox News show, on social media, and in his writings. He's published numerous books, including one in which he suggests that factional violence between the left and the right in the U.S. is inevitable.
Pete Hegseth, Trump's Pentagon pick, sparks alarm over far-right extremism. We'll speak with Guardian reporter Alice Herman on this first day of confirmation hearings for Defense Secretary. Then as Gaza ceasefire talks heat up, outgoing President Joe Biden defends his foreign policy.
The Palestinian people deserve peace and the right to determine their own future. Israel deserves peace and real security. And the hostages and their families deserve to be reunited. And so we're working urgently to close this deal.
We'll speak with Matt Dus in Jerusalem, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. His recent column, Democrats have become the party of war. Americans are tired of it. Then global pressure mounts for Israel to release Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the director of the pediatric Kamal Adwan Hospital.
Some of people who have been recently released just say something about my father, and they told that he has been tortured severely by the Israelis, and he was transferred to another prison.
We'll speak with a pediatrician who collaborated with Dr. Abu Safia to establish a feeding center in Gaza last year. And finally, how you can help the incarcerated firefighters battling LA wildfires. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Qatar's foreign ministry says Israel and Hamas are closer to reaching a ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza than at any time in the past. For the first time, delegations from Israel and Hamas are in the same building in Doha for negotiations, but they're not holding direct talks. Envoys of both President Biden and President-elect Trump are in Doha as well. On Monday, Biden spoke about the ceasefire talks in the final foreign policy speech of his presidency.
The war between Israel and Hamas, we're on the brink of a proposal that I laid out in detail months ago, finally coming to fruition.
Just last week, Biden notified Congress of a new $8 billion arms sale to Israel. In Israel, two far-right members of Prime Minister Netanyahu's government, National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, have spoken out against a possible hostage deal, with Ben-Gvir threatening to quit if a deal is reached. Meanwhile, Israel's continuing its assault on Gaza. Earlier today, an Israeli airstrike hit a home east of Khan Yunis, killing at least 9 Palestinians, including women and children. Ala al-Qadi lost his brother in the attack.
As you may know, he was a displaced. We were displaced from Rafah, and he was staying with his in-laws. He was martyred along with his relatives, his brothers-in-law, wife, and his 20 days old newborn baby. Just today, we were scheduled to visit my father. We were saying, thank God, there will be a ceasefire, and we will all go back to Rafah. But my brother was not destined to return.
Meanwhile, Israel has killed another Palestinian journalist in Gaza, Alam al-Nafet, who recently reported from the besieged Indonesian hospital for Dropsite News and other outlets. In a statement, Dropsite News said, quote,